KALW.
I don't understand how we're going to impact the budget in a positive way by closing schools.
Facing major budget shortfalls, San Francisco Unified School District is considering school closures and mergers to avert a looming financial crisis.
There's only about 14% of the budget is the operation of those schools. You'd have to shut down a third of our schools to close the budget gap.
Today, we hear how the school district's advisors, parents, and students are reacting to possible school closures. Then, a comedian reimagines art that's personal to him with a queer spark.
You know, when you're singing in the car and you're like, "Hey, well, that song wasn't really meant for me," but music is for everyone.
And we'll hear a reading about the dynamics of relationships from Berkeley author Chaz Halpern. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. San Francisco Unified School District has been struggling financially for years. Now, the district's considering school closures and mergers to help close the deficit. On May 6th, the District Advisory Committee, or DAC, held the first of three meetings to review the results of a stakeholder survey. It was conducted with help from a Stanford research team. This excerpt from that meeting begins with Ritu Khanna, SFUSD's head of research, describing how the survey was designed.
When we looked at it, the most important value was given to the criteria around school culture and climate, and the least important was given to attendance. Okay, so that's just as an example of a comparison. We also found that our underserved population rated historical inequities a lot higher than others. So you could see how both for schools and for neighborhoods, historical inequities was rated much higher by Latino, African Americans, Filipino, American Indian, and Pacific Islanders.
Okay. What's AI? AN?
AI is American Indian.
Oh, we pulled them out. Oh, cool.
Yeah. So what we did was, I'm so sorry, Orlando, go ahead.
Thank you. I think this is an important question on the next slide, please. Was the demographic of people responding representative of SFUSD? So if we look across all the different aspects,
excellent,
was generally
question.
Representative?
It was actually underrepresented, especially our underserved population. So what we did was, on this slide, you'll see this next column called weighted mean. Do you see the weighted mean? So in that, we adjusted for it. Okay, so we actually would double the responses of an African-American individual to make sure that they have the right representation as similar to our demographics. Okay, that's why you see a weighted mean. Okay, so weighted meaning we actually accommodated it and weighted it based on the demographics of SFUSD.
I hear the weighted mean, but I just... My heart is in the caution is saying that no one is a monolith in the danger of a single story. And so to add additional weight to a response that might come from a middle class Black family that lives on the West Side versus an incoming immigrant Black family from Ethiopia who's in the Tenderloin, it could be different. You see what I'm saying? So.
I think that's one of the reasons I was worried about this is because, you know, I work in community and a lot of our families that come into our hubs don't know how to use internet, don't have access to internet, don't have access to computers. So if the statistic reflects an underrepresentation, then how is SFUSD going to address that issue? Because we're only hearing those of us that have access to technology and doesn't reflect the ones that even in 2024 doesn't have access to technology.
Lauren Kohler, executive director of SFUSD enrollment, and Devin Corrigan, a liaison with SFUSD, respond.
There was 16 in-person community sessions at schools in communities. We texted the families who attend those schools and the families who attend around those schools. They were really focused on making sure that our underrepresented communities were able to get there. A lot of them were in languages other than English or had support for families' translation in languages other than English. So that was one of the really important things that we did to try and hear those voices. And I think Ritu's point with the weighted mean is to try and amplify those voices, even though they're sort of perhaps stuck in a technology vacuum.
Well, I can just add that I think that it's the unfortunate reality that we have our proportions of various demographic groups in the district, and anytime we ask for feedback on anything in a survey or any other modality, we would love for those numbers to line up exactly, and they do none of the time. And so we do the best we can to bring them together, and that's why we do the weighted means, and that's why we also have in-person events to triangulate, but those are sort of the best options we have to deal with the reality of those numbers always being a little off.
Another DAC member and a family liaison representative shared the challenges they experienced with the survey.
I have a comment, and it's about this. This is the most appropriate place for me to make it. And I came into this meeting today just having, after receiving a text from the district and your reminder email about the survey, and looks like, I don't know what the numbers are as far as responses so far, but clearly, like, you're trying to get more. So the issue that I had with this survey, the biggest one to me, was the excellence category. Because when I took part one of the survey as a parent, it was vague to me what those were supposed to mean or what they would have to do with whether a school should stay open or not, number one. Also, those seem to be categories that are very much dependent on two things. One is the demographic, the demographics of the school population, the socioeconomic status of the school population. And secondly, dependent on how the school has sort of been treated, for lack of a better word, by the district in terms of funding for a lot of the years. So that whole category was kind of troubling to me. But the thing that really struck me when I just took survey part two, which I know we're not talking about that, but I think it's relevant here, is that to complete part two of the survey, you have to use your coins in every category. Now, if you're someone who doesn't think that these criteria in the excellence, quote unquote, excellence category, which, like I said, I perceive those to be things that are very much decided by a lot of outside forces and have a lot to do with equity, you can't move on to through the survey until you rank those things. And there is no way of ranking them zero in part two of this survey.
We represent family liaisons. And so actually, our secretary and our community organizer attended family liaison PDs when they were launching the survey and trying to, like, looking at the survey and to support families to fill it out. And families were very, very confused. Like, they did not, even the liaisons were confused on how to get past this coin system. So that already became a barrier to be able to then help families fill out the forms, the surveys.
Here's Devin Corrigan and Ritu Khanna again.
I can share a little more, too, about in terms of understanding the populations that answered this survey versus those whom did not. We do have a way of saying more about that. And I just want to be clear that our policy always in our department every day is if we're going to release information, if we're going to release data, reports, we're always going to disaggregate that data by the groups that we are able to. And so in the case of this survey, that includes race, ethnicity. We ask questions about what schools you're affiliated with. Not everybody who answers the survey is necessarily affiliated with the school because it is open to the public, community members. But as you saw, most were parents, so there's a lot of affiliations. You can see what schools a respondent was affiliated with. You can see if they have a child who's receiving special education services, English language learner services, I mean, all kinds of things. So that is not a black box. That is something we do have data on, and as a policy, we would always release that information and not keep that from the public. So that will be clear. These data are, I should say again, preliminary, and these slides I know are sort of just scratching the surface. But when there are more results to release, I just want to be clear that we do have that data because it was collected on the survey, and we'll make sure that it's disaggregated in that way as we do in all of our reports.
The demographics of the respondents for each category that you filled out, there is a report already in our website that has been produced to describe the demographics for every section and Stanford's summary of their results.
Lauren Kohler gave a summary of where the DAC is in the process of drafting their recommendation that will then go to the Board of Education in June.
One of the features of the first survey was a question about things that were missing or criteria that people would like to see included. We saw 12 themes emerge, and they fell into three categories. So the first category were already included in the current criteria or in the equity checks. Those are transportation, funding inequalities, proximity, support programming like after-school programs, safety, sense of belonging, and the sense of staff feeling overworked. All of those things are included in either the equity criteria from AB 1912 or in some way included in the criteria that we have here. Other things that people suggested as criteria to add are set by a collective bargaining agreement, so teacher pay and administrator pay, so not things that we would include in the criteria because they're set by an agreement. And then there's three things for which we do not have current data. Those are teacher quality, school marketing, and stability.
The meeting closed with public comments, including these from a student and a parent from SFUSD.
I'm a student at June Jordan School for Equity. Less than 1% of SFUSD students participated in this survey. How do you plan to significantly increase student engagement? As a student, I feel disregarded. As a student, the situation feels repetitive and redundant. As a student, no, as a human being, this is unacceptable and outrageous that only 0.8% of students completed this form, leaving the remaining 99.2% unheard. Our voices are crucial. Sorry. We are the future. We were promised a visit from Dr. Wayne to sit and listen to our student voices, but he hasn't followed through. Do our voices not matter? Do our voices hold no weight? Do I have no say in my education? Thank you.
Hi, I'm a parent of a fifth grader. I don't understand how we're going to impact the budget in a positive way by closing schools. There's only about 14% of the budget is the operation of those schools. You'd have to shut down a third of our schools to close the budget gap. It seems like the main cost of this organization, as it is with most organizations, is salaries and benefits and affiliated costs. But it seems like we're short of teachers. So I don't understand the basic accounting. And I think there are some accountants on this committee. I would challenge you guys to really dig in and figure out what's going on with the budget. It's not buildings. Thank you.
That was part of a community input session that SFUSD held on May 6th. You can find a link to the full meeting at klw.org. The next meeting will be May 20th in the Board of Education meeting room. That's at 555 Franklin Street in San Francisco, and it is open to the public. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Baruch Porras Hernandez is a poet, a singer, and a comedian. He's performed around the Bay Area and across the country for years, and he's even performed inside a cave. Now he's producing and starring in Queer Classics, a reflective take on his life as a queer Latino. Here's Baruch in conversation with KALW's Sunni Khalid.
Baruch, what drives you and what really influences your art?
What fuels my art is an urge to connect with an audience, because no matter what I'm doing, whether I'm writing poetry or writing a solo performance or comedy, all I'm thinking about is how am I going to make that audience react and how am I going to create that sweet exchange of spark.
Baruch, who do you see your audience as? Do you see a different audience as a poet? Do you see a different audience as a comedian? Do you see a different audience as a performer? Are they all mixed together? Is there crossover? How do you see your public?
You know, the artists that I admire have always been loved by all. For example, Selena was loved by young people, old people, white people loved her, people from all over, Black people, Asian people loved her. Juan Gabriel, who is one of the artists from Mexico that I super admire, and I'm going to be doing a cover of one of his songs in this upcoming show, he was loved by everyone in Mexico. Even homophobic people loved Juan Gabriel, and he was one of the queerest artists on the planet. So I have always strived to be liked by everyone in my performance. And even when I have an audience that I can tell doesn't like me at the beginning, which often happens in comedy and poetry, sometimes you'll get on stage in an audience, you can see everyone's frowning, everyone's crossing their arms and looking at you like, oh, this guy, what's he gonna do? And I just love getting a smile on my face and going, oh, you are all gonna love me by the end of my set.
What was the inspiration behind Queer Classics?
Queer Classics, that idea kind of came to me because I remember being a young kid in Mexico and growing up with music all the time. I had a very artistic family on both sides that love poetry, love music. Mexican dinners at my mom's family's house usually ended with either a sing-along, you know, after everybody had a drink or two, you know, bring up the tequila, and all my uncles would start to sing their favorite song. All my aunts would start to sing their favorite songs. My mom would belt out a tune. And then after everyone was too tired from singing, my grandfather would recite one of his favorite poems and everybody would become very quiet. I was a kid in Mexico and I would be hearing these incredible songs by these Mexican artists. And then I would sing them to myself. If it was a song that a man wrote to a woman, I remember singing it in the bathroom and changing the genders to a man. So it was me singing to a man and just being secretive about it because I was terrified of people finding out. And so I decided, well, why don't I have a night of performances where me and other queer artists sing and celebrate the songs that we grew up with? And, you know, not there's so many songs. I think we're each going to do about one or two or three covers of songs from our past that we've always wanted to sing with a little queer spark. So that's kind of where that idea came from. You know, when you're singing in the car and you're singing a song that like you grew up with and you love, and you're like, eh, well, that song wasn't really meant for me when I was younger. But music is for everyone. So, you know, why not do a cover of a song you've always wanted to do, you know, in front of an audience? So when I approached the other artists with that idea, they all thought it was cool.
My most critical audience was always, you know, my mother, my aunt. I'm wondering if you've performed parts of Queer Classics for your family and what their reaction is, because I know they must be a pretty tough crowd.
Oh my, yes. My biggest critic is my mother. and she's the one really in the family that, I mean, she taught me how to draw when I was two. She has like pictures as evidence of me in diapers drawing. She would sing to my brother and I every night before, you know, at bedtime. That was like a big ritual for us. She was a singer herself in the 70s in Mexico. Her career didn't go very far because she decided to, you know, have a day job and be a mom and marry my dad and all that. But singing was very important to her. She taught me how to sing. She was an actor. I got most or 70% of my creative talents from her. So she is usually my biggest critic, and part of the show is for her. I used to be a singer myself. I was in choir. I was in a band after I was, you know, I graduated from college. And singing was always something that made my mother really, really proud. And I believe it was not just because she loves to hear me sing, but sometimes I know it was the language barrier. If she came to see me in a play, often she didn't understand what was going on in the play because of the language barrier. So after the play, she'd be like, wait, so why did that guy do that? And how come your character did this? But if she came to see me in a musical, she could just enjoy the music. She didn't have to understand what was happening because music is so universal. Even if you don't, you know, understand the lyrics, you can still get the feeling of a song. So when I stopped singing professionally for years, my mother and my family has been like, when are you going to go back? When are you going to go back? When are you going to sing again? And so this show on May 19th, I hope, you know, she's going to be in the front row. And I also hope she doesn't try to sing over me, because the first time I did a solo show, I was singing on stage and my mom thought it was a duet. And I had to like literally like stop and be like, Mom, this isn't a duet. And from the audience in the first row, my mother said, yes, but I created you and you wouldn't be here without me. So
you can't be a real legitimate act unless you have backup singers. I know that exactly. From some of the karaoke here at KALW. Listen, Baruch, you're known most in the Bay Area for being a host. What is it like for you to be the main event, the main attraction?
I kind of love both. Being a main attraction or a headliner or part of a show is, of course, always my goal. But I learned about, you know, 10-ish years ago that I love sharing. I love art and performance and music and comedy so much that I get like a little kid with like a rock collection. I want to show these beautiful things to everyone. When I first saw Sanjeev perform, we did a show together at Soma Arts, not that long ago because we're still young, but it was a while ago. And I was so mesmerized by the way he not only used his body as a dancer, but the way he took his culture, his upbringing, and used it in the performance in such like a unique, personal, and queer way, unapologetically. It moved me so much. I just was telling everyone about him. I was recommending him for gigs because I was like, people need to see this person do his art. And same goes for Dizzy Jenkins. The first time Dizzy Jenkins and I performed together was in an alleyway at City Lights Bookstore during the pandemic, because we were doing poetry shows outside with everybody wearing a mask. And even though she was wearing a mask, the way she like sang into the microphone and also did a rap, she does like a hip hop of mix and Afro Latino Puerto Rican music. It's just incredible to, even though she was wearing a mask and there was a mic and we were in alley and everybody was wearing masks and everybody was terrified because it was during the pandemic, she was able to move the audience in such a way that I was like, I can't, as a music lover, not keep recommending her for gigs. And so about 10 years ago, that's kind of how I got into hosting, because it was like, hey, I have talented friends. Look at my friends. You're going to move the way I was moved. I want you guys to laugh the way I laughed. I want this audience to cry the way this artist made me cry at the end of their performance.
That was comedian Baruch Porras Hernandez speaking with KALW's Sunni Khalid. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. You can listen to a longer version of that interview online, and you can watch Baruch perform live in Queer Classics at Oasis in San Francisco this Sunday. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Before we go, we'll hear a reading from Berkeley novelist Chaz Halpern. He reads from his book, The Physics of Relationships.
The book is an intimate story about three women, two older and one younger, who have been brought together by circumstance. I'll read you a very short section from chapter 2. Lexi, who narrates the novel, is a 63-year-old widow, and Danielle is a somewhat desperate, unemployed 30-year-old who's a friend of Lexi's daughter. And here we go. Danielle turned back toward the stove. I noticed that she was wearing flannel pajama bottoms with little red hearts on them. It was 6:40 p.m. It seemed a little odd to be wearing pajama bottoms, but I suppose that was her usual homewear, which meant that she was making herself comfortable. I was fine with that as far as it goes. I didn't want her to feel awkward or uncomfortable, but a little reticence on her part would have been appreciated. Enough reticence, for example, to have talked to me in advance about my meal plans. On the other hand, the pajamas were kind of cute and a little childlike. That pricked at my heart. Here was a young woman who had been dumped by her boyfriend, who had moved back across the country to her childhood home, but who didn't actually have a home there anymore. She was an only child, and she was estranged from her mother, who had moved to the planet Arizona to live with an alien. Her father was dead, and she was attempting to make dinner for me. I could hardly scold her.
That was Chaz Halpern reading from The Physics of Relationships. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse, and you can hear more author readings at klw.org/newarrivals. Tune in Monday morning at 11. San Francisco's highly watched mayoral election is just under 6 months away, and voters are listening in for what the candidates have to offer as they weigh their options.
Just like we need a change in the mayor's office, we need some change in the leadership in a number of different departments in this city.
We hear from District 11 Supervisor Asha Safai about his bid for the top job at City Hall. That's Monday morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rollins, Gonady Joe Johnson, Mary Catherine O'Connor, Johanna Miyake, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega Welch, Angela Johnston, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.